Hello and welcome back to LSHTM Viral. I'm Amy Thomas. A sudden change in life as we know it. Businesses shut, roads empty, streets bare. Efforts to curb the devastating effects of COVID-19 have broken the global economy and left governments striving to repair the damage and rebuild our future. As we tackle the global recession in the wake of this pandemic, there is an opportunity for us to rethink the world we want to create. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Sir Andy Haynes. Previous director of LSHTM, Andy is a renowned professor of environmental change and public health who is particularly interested in the study of environmental influences on health, including the potential effects of climate change and the health co-benefits of a low-carbon economy. Andy, welcome, and thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Thank you.
So the economy has suffered incredibly due to COVID-19, but there are discussions happening now about a real opportunity to build a new economy that prioritises health and sustainability. Andy, why do we need to do this?
Well, we need to do it because as we emerge from COVID-19, which obviously that emergence is going to take some time because there are going to be subsequent waves of infection. But as we do gradually emerge, it's essential that we do so on a healthy and sustainable trajectory. Essentially, the world economy has spent literally sort of trillions of dollars really to try to safeguard the health of the public through COVID. And it wouldn't make sense for us to emerge from COVID and damage health, take us back to an economy which encourages air pollution and which also puts us on a trajectory for dangerous climate change. So it really makes sense to emerge from COVID along a low carbon, hopefully ultimately zero carbon trajectory, reducing our dependence on fossil fuels, but also creating a more resilient economy to future shocks.
So you mentioned there creating resilience and shifting towards a low carbon economy. How are we going to do this? Does it mean phasing out businesses that contribute to non-renewable energy and fossil fuels?
Well, it does mean prioritising limited resources. So in considering which businesses to fund as we emerge from COVID, it's important, I think, that governments and other investors apply certain criteria. And those criteria could include environmental criteria, investment in zero carbon technologies, strategies, but also criteria which include health. So, for example, those businesses which foster, support health should be prioritised. And those whose products undermine health arguably should receive less generous or no investment from governments or from other private funders. So what's important really, I think, is to develop criteria which will help to steer the economy towards a much more sustainable basis, which will help to reduce the impact of future shocks. And of course, climate change is very much coming towards us very rapidly. COVID is the issue which is mobilizing us at the moment, focusing our attention. But climate change is coming very fast behind. And indeed, populations are already suffering from the effects of climate change as we speak. And that's going to increase as the years go by. So it's very important to get these policies right, because what COVID showed us is that if you respond late, then the effects on public health can be devastating. And in the case of climate change, of course, we have to make decisions before the effects become devastating. Because carbon dioxide, for example, stays up in the atmosphere for hundreds, some even thousands of years, portion of it. So at the moment, we don't know how to get that CO2 out of the atmosphere in a cost-effective way. So that means that we have to make decisions now to forestall increasingly dangerous and potentially catastrophic effects over decades and many years to come.
And so sort of going back to that decision making that you mentioned and potential sort of criteria that the government might adopt, is it possible to develop this kind of criteria? I mean, do we know how to develop that framework and what's the pushback against that?
Well, there has been quite a lot of progress in developing environmental criteria. So there's something called the low carbon designation, which was created by a Morningstar, which is a kind of to guide investment. And that has criteria which would direct investments towards low carbon technologies and products and so on. And it should be possible to complement these with health related criteria. Quite what those would be, obviously, would be a matter for discussion. But they could include manufacture of products that are essential for health, but also products that will help to reduce unhealthy exposures. One example might be renewable energy, which you could justify both on low carbon or zero carbon criteria, but also will bring big health benefits. So for example, fossil fuel related air pollution has been estimated to be responsible for around 3.6 million premature deaths worldwide annually, something of that order. In the EU, there's a potential to prevent about 430,000 premature deaths annually or so from air pollution attributable to burning fossil fuels. So in this case, one gets a double benefit, the environmental benefit of reducing greenhouse gas emissions and the health benefit of reducing air pollution exposure.
That's a really interesting point of balancing these two factors, health and sustainability. What about companies that are beneficial for health but have significant fossil fuel burning or impact in greenhouse gases? How do we weigh those up?
Well, that's a difficult balance, isn't it? But what's happening now is that increasingly health systems are undertaking steps to decarbonize themselves. And we see that particularly in case of NHS, which of course has committed itself to become carbon neutral. Currently, of course, 2050 is the phase out date, but we're hoping that they'll bring forward the level of ambition to decarbonize the health system. It's now become evident that health systems are probably responsible for about 5% of greenhouse gas emissions. And of course, they also are responsible for other pollutants. We use a lot of plastics and so on and a lot of other polluting compounds in health systems. And there's now a lot of activity around the world, some of it being undertaken by NGOs, such as Healthcare Without Harm, some being also promoted by governments, such as the work on the NHS, to decarbonize the NHS. So increasingly, what we're seeing is synergies between health and environment, with the health sector, the healthcare sector, showing real leadership. So increasingly, we should be able to direct investments to products which are both environmentally and health promoting. And that's certainly something which we need to prioritize for the future.
There have been some concerns that countries receiving state aid packages in the wake of COVID-19 are jeopardising the EU's zero carbon goals by not considering sustainability in the payout. How do we encourage the use of public money in supporting EU Green Deal objectives?
Well, again, I think we've got to go back to establishing clear criteria for prioritising these kind of investments. And those criteria should include the combination of environmental sustainability and health. As you say, there has been quite a lot of concern, both within the EU, but also more globally, that some of the companies receiving bailouts are those that are very heavily dependent on fossil fuels and also don't really have credible plans to decarbonize themselves. And so if funding is given to these companies, and we would argue they probably shouldn't be very high priority, but if they are given resources, then that should be conditional on actually presenting a implementable plan for rapid decarbonisation. So I think there are different ways of approaching this, and different governments and different regulatory authorities will take slightly different positions. But the ultimate idea is to use these post-COVID stimulus funds to really rapidly accelerate and scale up the transition to the zero carbon economy, which is something that we really need to do very quickly if we're going to avert the risk of dangerous climate change. We also know that if these are properly designed, that these investments can promote real job opportunities. So in 2018, for example, 11 million people worldwide we were employed in the renewables sector. And if the pre-crisis investments are not redirected, this number could rise to 42 million jobs globally by 2050. So the renewable energy sector is a potentially a major employer. And if you add to that other sectors that promote sustainability using a range of much more sustainable products and approaches, then you can see that there could be a range of other job opportunities. One example would be, for example, the retrofitting of housing with insulation to reduce heat loss. That has the potential to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels, but also provide useful and much needed employment.
So this seems like quite an obvious way forward. What is stopping governments investing in these types of businesses?
Well, of course, these businesses at the moment contribute quite a large amount of to our economy. And so it's not easy to change direction overnight. And this, again, emphasizes the need for advanced planning when it comes to the climate emergency, because we've seen that it's extremely painful economically to suddenly shut down sectors of the economy. And we don't want to have to do that in the face of a climate emergency as well. So that's why we need to make provision now. And we need to direct investments now with a view to this climate emergency, which is coming over the horizon at us. So one of the barriers, of course, is the immense economic and political power of the fossil fuel industries. I think another barrier, obviously, is the fact that they're employing large numbers of people, and just making them redundant is politically, obviously, and socially unacceptable. So that is why redeployment of people into these more productive sectors of the economy needs to occur rapidly, in order to smooth this transition to the zero carbon economy.
So aside from directly impacting on the economy, that the pandemic has also shifted our culture of working, can we still argue that energy heavy practices like driving to work every day in our cars or flying to conferences and meetings is a necessary part of the economy or indeed working life?
Well, I think what's happened with COVID has certainly challenged those assumptions. If we think back even a few months ago, it's almost inconceivable that we would have seen the dramatic changes that we have seen. And people have had to adapt very, very quickly. So many practices which we thought face-to-face contact was absolutely essential for have now been transferred online. And certainly, anecdotally, talking to colleagues, although it's been painful in some cases, it has gone reasonably well. And in some cases, actually gone a lot better, because we don't have this exhausting travel to meetings and conferences. We're actually able to focus our attention on the meetings at hand. And so I think there have been some benefits as well as some disbenefits. I think increasingly we will see changes in the way in which people work. Probably people will spend more time working from home, perhaps come into work less frequently. After all, what counts is their productivity. Do they deliver? Do they also feel comfortable working in this way? Are homes adapted for people to work in this way? And we need to ensure that we don't unintentionally actually increase energy use, because after all, if you're working at home all the time, you have increased costs, energy costs and so on. So that brings us back to the importance of ensuring that homes are comfortable and that they're energy efficient. It takes us back to this important question of how we can retrofit in the UK many of our somewhat obsolete houses that we all live in. We are going to see dramatic changes. At the same time, there will still be obviously a need to move between cities, between countries, and we will need to find the most energy efficient and low carbon way of doing that. That's going to be a particular challenge because of the problem of transmission of COVID in public transport. So for the next couple of years, there will be difficult challenges as how we can most optimize the use of public transport, perhaps through staggering people's working hours, ensuring some level of social distancing on public transport. So that will be a challenge, no question. But it also is an opportunity to change people's travel patterns, so to foster more cycling and walking, as we're seeing in a number of cities now. And that can have a permanent change on people's behavior and benefit health as well as the environment.
And several cities, as you mentioned, including Milan, Paris and London, have announced new car-free zones in the wake of the pandemic. Do you feel hopeful about these measures as a potential shift towards the low-carbon economy? Or is there a fear that, you know, we will resume life as normal once the threat of COVID disappears?
Well, I think that's very much in the balance at the moment. What is crucial, though, is to get the sort of pricing structure right. So at the moment, we're kind of subsidizing fossil fuels, because we don't actually pay the full economic costs. You know, when we burn fossil fuels, we don't pay the costs of the air pollution or the costs of the greenhouse gases, the impact of climate change on our economy in the future. And so essentially we're subsidizing these damaging and polluting economic activities. And what we need to do is to get the pricing structure right. So that doesn't necessarily mean overall increasing the tax burden, but it might, for example, mean increasing carbon pricing, but then reducing the tax burden elsewhere in the economy and recycling some of those taxes to stimulate the kind of activities that would be environmentally beneficial and beneficial for our health. So I think it's a real opportunity to think again about how we configure our economy, what kind of policies we have in place, and whether by fine-tuning those, we can actually set ourselves along a much more sustainable trajectory.
We've talked about a range of issues. What do you think is the most important thing for governments to consider in this economic recovery in relation to health and sustainability?
Well, the most important thing to consider is how we get the balance of policies right. And that means getting the incentives and the levers right and ensuring that when we do invest our relatively scarce resources, that we invest those wisely. And we would argue that that needs to be through a mixture of policies which support healthy and sustainable recovery, putting human health and sustainability at the heart of the economy. One of the challenges we've had up to now is that we tend to focus on economic growth, you know, which is increasing the gross domestic product of our country, or indeed of all countries. But that's really rather poor indicator of human welfare and of sustainability. So we need to change the metrics by which we judge the success of our society. And the metrics ought to be focused much more on health, on ensuring greater equity, and ensuring that everyone has access to the opportunities provided by the economy. So much more equitable and development, but within these environmental constraints. So taking into account the need to rapidly decarbonize the economy. So I think this conceptual shift from an economy which is based on constant GDP growth to an economy which is based on human progress within environmental boundaries is going to be a crucial step that needs to be taken.
Just to round off the discussion, I'm interested in the discussions that you've had and in your opinion, do you feel hopeful that, you know, governments are really taking this on board and that we will begin to shift in this direction?
Well, when people ask me about hope, I usually respond that I'm neither optimistic or pessimistic. I've tried to make projections on the basis of the best available evidence. And at the moment, it's a very mixed picture. I mean, we're not going to reach the Paris Agreement target of 1.5 degrees global mean temperature increase, which is what was the optimal target from the Paris Agreement. We may, hopefully, we will reach the 2 degree level. Of course, we are seeing dramatic pushback in some countries. So obviously in the US, under the Trump administration, we're seeing a lot of the post-COVID stimulus funds going into the fossil fuel industry. And in Brazil also, we're seeing considerable pushback against some of these ideas. But other countries are moving forward. And as we've heard, the EU, the European Green Deal. So we're seeing some countries are continuing to strive towards meeting their Paris Agreement and other international agreement targets, others are pushing back. But I do think the direction of travel is clear. The price of fossil fuels, if you take into account all the externalities, all the damage it causes, really outweighs the cost of renewables. The cost of renewables is declining relatively rapidly, and increasingly they're becoming more competitive. I think some of the other sectors are perhaps more difficult. And I think the food sector is one. And of course, we here in the school, we do a lot of work on sustainable food systems and diets. And that's certainly an area where we do need a lot more work about how we can change people's dietary patterns, how we can give people the opportunity to eat healthier and more sustainable diets. So that is an abiding challenge. But we are seeing some progress in some sectors, and we need to build on that.
Thank you so much, Andy. That was a very balanced view. Is there any sort of final points that you would like to leave our listeners with before we end the discussion?
Well, I think I would say it's a very exciting time, because I think that health has moved very much up the kind of ladder of global priorities over recent months. So there's no question really that the health community in its broad sense, public health, healthcare, health policy makers and so on, have much more influence now than they did even a few months ago. And I think that when health professionals speak out in favour of a healthy and sustainable transition from COVID, that is having a lot of influence. And we're also seeing an increasing interest in the climate change negotiations in the COP26 conference, which will take place now in Glasgow next year, of bringing health in as a key kind of cross-cutting theme. It's not one of the official themes of the conference, but it's very clear from our discussions with those involved in the organisation of it that there is an increasing appetite to raise the profile of health and increasingly to put health at the centre of the whole climate change debate. And I think that's a very, very positive step that we ought to applaud and support. I would also say to the research community that there is increasing interest in supporting research in the whole field of environmental change and health, including a strong solution-focused element to that research, both in terms of how we can adapt to environmental change, but also how we can mitigate it, how can we rapidly reduce the environmental footprint of society whilst securing health advances in the long term. So I think it is a very exciting time at the moment, and certainly there's everything to play for. And there's a greater prospect that health can have a really important catalytic role in shaping some of the debates around sustainable development, climate change, biodiversity loss, and so on.
Great. Thank you so much, Andy, for joining us on the podcast. I thought that was a fantastic discussion. If you want to find out more about planetary health research that's happening at LSHTM, you can sign up to the Planetary Health mailing list. If you visit the website www.lshtm.ac.uk/research/centres, you will find the Centre on Climate Change and Planetary Health and information about signing up to the mailing list. So do head there if you are interested. Thank you again for listening to LSHTM Viral. Please keep sharing with your colleagues and your friends. Goodbye for now.